to the Satipatthana approach to mindfulness. And for those of you who weren't here then, the idea is that it really helps to have freed up our breathing process, to have a more natural, easy breath in order to meditate. We put a lot of emphasis in our tradition on not manipulating the breath or doing anything particular with the breath, just feeling it. And but sometimes if people haven't, you know, if people have a very controlled breath or contracted breath, it's maybe unfortunate not to first free it up a little bit. So last month was hopefully an attempt to try to get you into the breath and relaxing with the breath and in having more of an enjoyable breath. And it's not necessarily an easy task to discover, but I think it's well worth trying to do that. Now, the overall theme for the year of these Dharma practice days is the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse that the Buddha gave called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And it's the Buddha gave a variety of different meditation practices or ways of doing meditation, but this particular discourse is very important for our tradition. And the mindfulness, the insight meditation tradition really comes out of this discourse. And the discourse offers a great promise. And some of you, I think, know the discourse quite well, but even so, it's probably well worth reading the promise of what this practice, the promise that the practice offers. The Buddha said, "This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the Four Foundations of Mindfulness." So that's a pretty tall order, to somehow purify and surmount all sorrow and lamentation, all pain and grief, and for a realization of Nibbana, for liberation. And then the Buddha is going to describe what these four foundations are in this text. And the first category of the four foundations, the first foundation is that of the body. The second is of what's called, I call it feeling tones. The third is mental states. And then the fourth is the dharmas, the mental patterns, the patterns of the psychological patterns that come into play that keep us either in bondage or free us. And one way of understanding the four foundations of mindfulness is that they are offering a new frame of reference of how to frame our experience. The human experience is quite complex. There's a lot of things going on, and there's many ways in which you could understand your experience as human beings, many ways you could categorize it, many ways you can kind of interpret it. And you know, it's easy to see sometimes in different cultures that different cultures people divide up or understand human experience in different ways. And some of it, you know, it's somewhat arbitrary. Different cultural ways, different personal ways of dividing up the pie of human experience. You can divide up a pie in many different ways. You can divide the pie in quarters and thirds or eighths or twelfths. Or you can, you know, it doesn't have to be, it can be divided up unevenly. So the human, the pie of human experience can be divided up and interpreted different ways. A lot of human beings, a lot of us, I think, have certain categories or ways of understanding who we are that are very conceptual. Many of us then see our life, interpret our life through these conceptual overlays. And one of the most common ones is the overlay of a self. And putting aside the issue, is there or is there not a self? Once you posit a self, that becomes a magnet for many different interpretations and ideas about what a self is supposed to be like. Preferred self, ideal self, self, we don't want to, you know, all kinds of ideas around self. We have self-image issues. And many people are making their way through life very much in reference to their self-image. And self-image is always right there. How are people seeing me? How am I presenting myself? What are my clothes I'm going to wear? What I'm going to say? What my beliefs are? What my opinions are? All I have to do is somehow reinforcing or protecting or defending a self-image. And there are other things that are a little like self-image or self-identity. You know, we have certain identities, certain things we choose to define. This is who I am. I define myself by my emotions. I define myself by my beliefs. I define myself by my ethnicity. I define myself by my gender. I define myself by many different things. And these are all ways of taking the human experience and making order out of it, meaning out of it, or interpretations out of it. And some of the ways we do that can cause a lot of suffering. Some of the ways we do it are problematic from the very beginning. So if you could have an innocent kind of self-image. I think it's necessary to have it to get through life. But you can be caught up in the whole world of self-image so that you know, you're going to suffer no matter what. And so I know people who look at fashion magazines sometimes. I read a study or heard about a study once about something like the majority of the women who read fashion magazines feel worse after they read it than before they read it. And so that's why do they look at it? And so the idea of you know, this self-image comes into play there very dramatically in understanding who we are in relationship to self-image. And some of you heard me do the teachings about comparative thinking. A lot of the problematic ideas of self arise in comparison to others. So, you know, you say, you know, I'm too tall, I'm too short, I'm too fat, I'm too this, I'm too that. And all those are ideas of comparisons. Things like tall and short don't exist except by what you compare it to. And if you say that, if you're 5 foot and say, I'm much too short, you know, and my self-image is, oh, I'm too short. That's comparing yourself to a group of people who are maybe on the average taller than 5 feet. If you go, you know, to the pygmies in Africa, you know, you'd be a giant for them, and a whole different self-image would arise if that's where you lived. And so there's certain concepts of self that arise in contrast to what we compare ourselves to, in relation to what we compare ourselves to. And we compare ourselves in ways sometimes that cause suffering to ourselves or suffering to others. And that's a whole, comparative thinking is a whole way of understanding or organizing our experience of who we are as a self. So what the Buddha, I think, one of the ways of understanding the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations, is the Buddha is offering a new or different frame of reference for how to understand our experience. To not understand our experience through the concepts of self, or self-image, or self-identity, through comparative thinking, but to understand our experience according to these four different categories, to extend our experience much more directly and immediately through the experiences of the body, understanding the immediacy of the bodies, not through comparative thinking or abstractions, but to understand, experience the body in a very direct way. The other three foundations are particular ways of understanding our experience. So the feeling tone of our experience. The theory in Buddhism that every experience we have has a feeling tone to it. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And if you tune into that part of your experience, just the kind of the amoeba-like or the raw, primal kind of feeling tone of the experience, you have a very different relationship to your experience than if you just ignore that and pay attention to some other category of way of understanding your experience. So if you look at fashion magazines and you pay attention to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, then I think you get wise very quickly. But if you pay attention to self-image and fantasy world and what that, you know, you have a different relationship. So the Buddha says, actually, when you look at fashion magazine, you know, it's more useful for your liberation to look at pleasant and unpleasant than look at the world of fantasy and imagination. So one way of understanding Satipatthana is that the Buddha is offering four different frames of reference. These are four useful ways of looking at your life experience that are helpful for the purposes of doing what this text is aiming at, which is purification of beings, the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way for the realization of Nibbana. So that's the goal. And given that goal, what's the useful way of framing our experience? Framing experience does not necessarily mean that it's not necessarily an interpretation, or it's not necessarily an overlay, but it's just saying, focus on this aspect of your experience. This is pretty foundational. And this aspect, if you focus on these aspects of your experience, this will be conducive for your liberation. So if you sit watching your breath, and you kind of experiencing your breath meditation through the filter, through the frame of self-image or self-identity, your experience might be something like this. It might be, oh, I'm a really bad breather. I really don't know. I don't know if I could really even admit to my fellow group of meditators here that how terrible I am at following my breath, because I'm in a Buddhist center, and a Buddhist image is a person who's centered and, you know, able to stay with the breath and has this wonderful, deep, natural breath. And this is embarrassing, and I can't, you know, do this. And maybe I should sit in the back of the room, or maybe out there, you know, far away, so that no one really notices how I'm breathing. And that's all, you know, experiencing your breath through a particular frame of reference, which is not very helpful, right? The frame of reference the Buddha recommends is simpler than that. In relationship to the breath, he says, when you breathe in a long breath, know that you're breathing in a long breath. When you're breathing in a short breath, know you're breathing in a short breath. When you're breathing out, a long breath, know you're breathing out a long breath. When you're breathing out a short breath, know you're breathing out a short breath. Now, that's pretty boring for a spiritual tradition. Right here, you come to this great world religion, has great promise of enlightenment, and you know all this wonderful glory and stuff. And you could be sitting there with the Dalai Lama today in Stanford, you know. Great thing, right? And you come to this place and it says, you know, this is what you do. When you're breathing in a short breath, know it's a short breath. When you're breathing in a long breath, know you're breathing out a long breath. I mean, you know, it's not very sexy. But the suggestion here is it's actually quite profound. For one thing, it's experiencing the breath in its simplicity of how it actually is, independent of interpretations. Long and short is maybe a little bit of interpretation. You have to compare long and short is compared to what? But it's very rudimentary, very basic, as compared to the other things, like, you know, the self-image kind of things around the breath. And there could be other kind of relationships to the breath. There could be, oh, I'm breathing in a short breath, and I'm always breathing in a short breath, and this is terrible, and all kinds of things, all kinds of interpretations come into play. The suggestion here for the Buddha is it's very helpful to begin cutting through a lot of the interpretations and concept and self-image frames of reference that we use to understand our life. And one of the ways to do that is to begin experiencing something like the breath in its simplicity, as simply as you can. And the more you can do that, the less energy, the less attention you give to the other kind of choices you have to how to interpret your experience. So it's actually quite profound. It cuts through. Breath meditation can cut through issues of self-identity, of fantasy, of destructive thoughts, of interpretations, and a lot of other things that makes our experience much more complicated than it needs to be. Here, the suggestion is make it as simple as possible. Just breathe and experience the breath as it actually is. Then it goes on, and it says, the person then trains in the following way. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. So not only experiencing the breath as it actually is, but then expanding the awareness to become aware of the full breath experience, the fullness of it. And that can be interpreted in different ways. It can be interpreted as being the full inhalation from beginning to middle and end, or it can be the whole breath, the whole body breathing, the whole experience, not just in one place like at the nostrils or at the belly, but the whole experience of the global experience of the body breathing. And we did some of that last month when we met. And then the next thing to do with the breath is I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formations. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formations. So the first one is just breathing, experiencing the breath in the whole body. And then has a new expression, the bodily formations. And the bodily formation is a subcategory of the whole body. The bodily formation is that part of your body that arises because of your intentions. It's called sankharas. It's that part of your experience, the physical experience of your body, which, like for example, if you go around being tense, your shoulders might be tense. The tension in your shoulder is a formation. It's a construction. It's something that you've contributed to make. It's your intentional life, your psychological life, which is then shaped part of your physical experience in having its tense shoulders. Same with the belly, same all kinds of ways. The great sage Abraham Lincoln said at one point that by the time a person is 40, he or she is responsible for their face. Meaning that, you know, the way we, our attitudes, our emotions, our feel, everything, you know, gets expressed in our muscles. And so, I don't know if it's true what he said, but exactly, but it has some truth. When I was a little kid, 5 years old, there was a woman my family knew who never smiled because she was afraid of getting wrinkles. So the bodily formations is that part of our physical experience which we somehow shaped by our formations, by our the way we've lived our life, our attentions, our psychology. And it's much deeper than most can meet the eye, most of us, how much that's the case. And you get a little sense of that if you go visit different countries. I see it this way. Sometimes I met people from Latin America, Mexico and places, who were born there and grew up there. But their parents were, for example, German. They were born in Germany, and both were Germans. And they moved to Mexico and had kids, and the kids grew up as Mexicans. And I said, look at their face, and they have all these, you know, German genes. But they have this kind of little bit of kind of way of their faces. It's more Latin. And I understand it to be the way they speak the language. Spanish is different. You use different muscles in speaking Spanish than you do if you're speaking German. So it shapes the face a little bit differently. There's different expressions that they make in Mexico than they would in Germany, and that expresses, you know, itself and how the muscles get developed in the face. And so there's these changes that happen because they're cultural. So that also speaks to how deep this idea of the mental formations, what happens in our bodies also kind of shaped much more than we tend to realize. So then the Buddha says, in experiencing the breath, I shall breathe out, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing, calming, relaxing the bodily formations. So this is actually where we actually do something. We're actually relaxing. And so that's the justification for our first class. Last class is kind of relaxing and softening, relaxing the breath and changing it. So there is a place in Vipassana practice for changing your experience. Even though some of you might have heard me and other people say, in mindfulness we just notice what's there, we don't do anything else. But here there's actually both that are going on. Initially there's a stage where you just see the breath for what it is. And I extrapolate from short to long to be just experience, get to know the breath as it actually is in various ways. And then, and once you get to know it, then begin to kind of expand your experience of the breath so it's more global through your body. So it's an exercise of stretching your awareness to be aware of the fullness of the breath as it's kind of experienced throughout the body. And once you can do that, then it's helpful to relax and tranquilize, calm the bodily formations, the body, in some way or other. And that is what it says about the instructions of mindfulness of breathing in this text. And as I've said, this is a frame of reference for how to look at our experience. And whenever you take a new frame of reference for your experience, you have to contend with the fact that you have a strong habit of using a different frame from the past. And so so part of what we're trying to do then is develop certain concentration and continuity where we can keep to the new frame of reference and let go of the old frame of references. So if the old frame of reference is judging the breath, every breath as being good or bad, that frame of reference is not being used. Good and bad is not being used in this practice here. The frame of reference that's being used is just, how is it in and of itself? Is it long? Is it short? Is it relaxed? Is it constricted? Is it smooth? Is it jerky? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it expansive? Is it contractive? You know, just kind of feeling it, how it actually is. So that's an introduction. What do you think? Do you have any questions about that or comments? Reservations? Makes sense? Makes good. Just like that? Yes?
So the part about tranquilizing the breath, is that... Do you start with the breath and then the tranquility comes? Or do you start with the tranquility to create the breath? Or I'm questioning the degree of, I guess, consciousness.
Right, or choice. Or, right. Yes. It's a good question. And if you follow the sequence here, then you first spend a period of time just getting to know it. Just knowing it. And then once you know it, then you expand the awareness. You train your awareness in a particular way to be much more expansive, to experience the whole breath body in some way. That can be partly developing concentration, partly developing greater global awareness. And then once you've done that, then you do this tranquilizing, where you relax it, relax the bodily formations, relax the body in some way. So it's three steps, and that doesn't have to be done in 2-3 minutes. It can be done over, you know, 3 hours, you know, an hour for each, or, you know, you could take a month for each of those steps or longer. And now, just being aware of the breath in and of itself, long, short, whatever, all the different ways, just feeling the breath in and of itself, being present for the breath, concentrating the breath, is tranquilizing. Many people know that, right? If you're anxious, people, you're told to breathe deeply, just breathe. So that's just, in and of itself is tranquilizing. And there's plenty of teachers who skip this or don't include this part of the instruction about using the breath and tranquilizing. It's enough just to focus on the breath, and it's tranquilizing. The byproduct of that is tranquilizing. You don't have to do anything to tranquilize. You don't have to do anything to calm it. So that's, you know, one option you have, is to interpret this to mean that this is a byproduct. This is a natural process that follows your concentration. The danger of being intentional around this, of choosing to do that, is that for many people, the sense of being the one who controls is a problem. As soon as we try to change something, we might still have old frames of reference, old understandings about self and what needs to happen, and I'm the one in control, and I have to get somewhere, and I have to get there quickly, and I'm not getting there as quickly as my neighbors, and it's all these a whole constellation of neurotic problems can arise in connection to trying to change your experience. And so, because an unfortunate high number of human beings are neurotic, sometimes the wisest strategy is to tell them, don't try to change anything. Just stay with how things actually are. And just notice that, and stay with the breath and its simplicity, and don't try to manipulate or tranquilize anything, because you just tie yourself in knots. And I know people who tie themselves in knots around the breath, and just not very productive. So you have a lot of choices. One choice is to just stay with the breath and let whatever tranquilizing is going to happen naturally. Or you could choose to breathe deeply, or breathe in such a way that you relax. And What you decide to do might depend a little bit on what you feel the need is in any given time. When I have a cold, when I'm sick, that's a time where I spend a lot of time in my meditation just tranquilizing the body, just relaxing all the muscles. That's a great time to do that, I find. And other times, you know, if I'm feeling, you know, tense somehow, I find it useful to do that. But if I sit down and feeling basically pretty relaxed and happy and centered, I won't spend any time doing that. I'll just focus on the breath as it is. So there's various choices. Is this helpful at all?
I like what you said last month about if you notice your breath or your body or is kind of tense, to widen the focus of your attention rather than to focus on some thought that you might be having that's creating tenseness. Yeah. So that has worked. That's worked for me.
Great, thank you. And so there's many things that work. And so I think part of the task of using the breath as a focus of meditation is over hopefully the years and decades you do it, you're actually learning more and more about the intricacies of it, how it works, and what works for you. And it's a skill and knowledge that you develop. So it's not something that you're going to master, you know, between now and 3:30 today. I think it's actually more useful to think about it something that you're actually never going to master it. It's something that you're going to actually be continually learning from and working on for the rest of your life if you do this. And the idea of mastering it, you know, maybe is not so useful. It's more useful to kind of learn, and you'll learn a lot as you go along here and develop this capacity.
You know, I use both at different times also, and one of the things that I found was a benefit of tranquilizing the body is that it makes it so much easier to do it at other times.
Once you develop a capacity to do it,
right?
Then when there's a crisis, you have the skills to do it.
Or even just when I'm sitting at the computer working.
Yeah.
You know, that can often be a crisis too.
So I said all this morning partly
Gil, I just want to say quickly that your answer to the woman over there was extremely helpful to me, and you just hit a lot of nails right on the head. And so I want to just express my appreciation to you for all of your abilities and scholarship and all that you give us. It's really very nice. So I thought I'd just do that publicly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And so part of my rationale for starting the day this way, before our first meditation, was in an attempt to make you a little bit more willing to shift your frame of reference as we sit here, as we do the sitting. So kind of simplify your frame of reference, let go of many of the old frame of references that you might have used for, you know, some of the neurotic ones for following the breath, and be willing to kind of shed a lot of things and just kind of be really simple with the breath. See if you can be really simple. And just be content and happy and satisfied. Nothing needs to happen. Nothing needs to be changed. All you got to do is stay with the breath and experience and feel it as it actually is. Get to know it. Explore it. Become familiar with it. And the more fully you can engage it in the process of getting to know it, and enter into the world of their breathing, the more all the other things will fall away. And that's helpful. So let's do a sitting. If you'd like to stand for a little few seconds and stretch, you've been sitting now for a while, might be nice.